have any other late additions to the agenda on the floor? Seeing none, we will move on to our next item, which is our visit from President Martha Pollack and Vice President Ryan Lombardi. We can welcome those in.
There we go.
A little bit closer, if you can.
There we go. I want to start with some very sad and difficult news that I know many of you have heard. A first-year student, Matthew Friedman, Cal's class of 26, passed away yesterday. It's not clear how he passed away. It appears that it may have been in his sleep. And unfortunately, it's going to be a little bit of time before the medical examiner is able to understand what led to his death. Student and Campus Life has been holding community support meetings beginning last night for impacted communities, and there will be more today in the near future. At this time, of course, the most important thing is to support his friends and even more his family, and I would like to ask for a brief moment of silence before I continue my comments. Thank you. So a few updates. I want to begin by telling you about the students who are going to join you next year, the class of 2027. They received their acceptance letters a couple of weeks ago. We have 4,994 students admitted to that class. We expect a final class of about 3,500 first-year students, which is consistent with our enrollment goals, plus another 600 or so transfers. They come from every state in the United States, plus Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, the United States, Virgin Islands, Guam, and American Samoa, as well as 87 countries, and they're citizens of 114 different countries. It's an extraordinary cohort who will follow in all of your footsteps. I also want to remind you all on admissions that, as I announced in December, I've established a task force on undergraduate admissions who will interrogate every aspect of the undergraduate admissions processes and will recommend university-wide policies and best practices guided by Cornell's founding mission. There were requests that went out for input from students, and the task force is taking into account the responses they received. I want to say a few words about tuition and financial aid because I know that's always an important topic. We do, I think as everyone knows, commit to meeting the full financial need of accepted undergraduates, and about half of our students receive financial aid. This year's increases in tuitions, which were well below the rate of inflation, will be covered with increased grant aid for most students receiving financial aid. So that means that most students who are receiving financial aid will not see an increase in costs for the coming year. Affordability and access, while always a challenge, and we recognize that, are a major priority for us, and they're a major goal in our current philanthropic campaign. I've told this group before that we're looking to raise $500 million in philanthropy for financial aid to do three things. We want to increase the number of students with aid by 1,000 while we're growing the undergraduate class by 650. We want to reduce the average debt for students with aid by 25%. And we want to provide at least one waiver of the summer savings expectation for students with no loan packages. Thanks to the really tremendous response of our Cornellian community, we're already two-thirds of the way towards our $500 million goal. We've raised more than $340 million to date. Our alumni really do care about affordability. And as a result of that, we were able to speed up the implementation of our expanded aid program. Hopefully some of the people in this room were recipients of that. We had about 4,700 undergraduates who received increases in grant aid of between $500 and $1,500 for the current semester. And that increase in grant aid, of course, decreases the amount of loan or work study. There'll be further increases coming this fall, with about 7,100 students receiving further increases of up to $1,800 in grant aid. We've also implemented the summer savings expectation waiver. If you qualify, if you participate in a qualifying experience Cornell opportunity, you can apply online for a one-time waiver of your summer earnings expectation. The forms available online, Google Experience Cornell, through the Office of Financial Aid. The due date is May 15th, so you have a bit of time, but not an enormous amount of time. If you're thinking about participating in the summer experience, be sure to get that form. I want to take a moment to acknowledge our amazing student athletes. I want to congratulate the Cornell wrestling team which finished third in the nation in the NCAA championships last month. Yanni Diakamahalo. For 4 years I've been saying his name and I still stumble over it. Yanni Diakamahalo won his fourth NCAA championship, becoming just the fifth athlete in Division I history to win four times in a row. In women's squash, senior Siva Subramanian came in second nationally for the second time in a row, finishing her career as the 2023 Ivy League Player of the Year. And our men's hockey team is having a terrific season. They made it to the so-called Elite Eight of college hockey. Also, our women's lacrosse team is off to a strong start. And our men's team is undefeated in the Ivy League and is currently in the top five nationally. Okay, the rest of my comments, I want to address some recent resolutions that have come out of SA. I was very pleased to be able to support resolution number 22 on cooperative housing. As I noted in my response and you pointed out, such housing can serve as a special and important community for our students, and it could be an economical and option. And the Housing and Residential Life Office will gladly advertise any properties that have met the requirements for affiliated housing. I was also glad to accept resolution number 20, dependable and inclusive supply of pharmaceutical and essential non-description supplies. Good for you, just sense. You're like the U.S. Congress coming up with these acronyms. The team at Cornell Health is continuing to work through the logistics of making this happen. They are fully committed to doing so. They're exploring some legal details to determine if we can use existing vending machines on campus or whether we'll have to have dedicated machines that are owned and operated by Cornell Health. But either way, it looks very promising that one solution or another will be in place by this summer. Turning on now to one that I wasn't able to accept, resolution number 15 and the request for a staff gynecologist at Cornell Health. Let me again explain the situation. Cornell Health is a primary care clinic. It doesn't and it can't provide specialty care. The Cornell population doesn't require a lot of specialty care, and that means it would be very, very difficult to recruit specialists, whether they're gynecologists or dermatologists, or urologists or gastroenterologists, or any other specialty. We just don't have enough to keep them busy. And with very few patients, it would also be cost prohibitive. Beyond that, and this is really important to know, many specialties, and this includes OBGYN, require regular opportunities for surgical engagement for a physician to maintain their skills and licensure. We can't provide that because we're not a surgical center. Now, as I mentioned in my response with respect to gynecology, our primary care doctors can address many concerns, including preventive care and screening, some minimally invasive clinical procedures such as IUD insertion, as well as the majority of pelvic pain conditions. And when advanced specialty care or surgical intervention is needed, the primary care clinicians will refer students to specialist providers. We have heard the concern that our students need better access to this kind of specialty consultation. And we're responding to that by expanding our partnership with Weill Cornell Medicine in a number of ways. In the area of gynecology, after general exams conducted by primary care physicians in Cornell Health, students will have the opportunity for telehealth appointments with a specialist at Weill Cornell Medicine for further support or treatment if the treatment can't be provided here at Cornell Health at no additional cost. In radiology, we're already using Weill Cornell Medicine radiologists to read images at Cornell Health. In psychiatry, starting this fall, we're going to add additional psychiatric support for medication management services with our physician at Weill Cornell Medicine, in addition to those provided by Cornell Health staff. All of this works. We will keep on with it. We really want to expand those partnerships and make these doctors available to all of you. And finally, let me say a word about Resolution 31, a content warning, one that all of you know has sparked a lot of national interest. I know you all read the response that Provost Mykolkov and I wrote, in which we explained why we feel that content warnings are at odds with our core university commitments to free expression and academic freedom. These are really incredibly important topics, so I want to spend just a little bit of time on them. It is true that upholding a commitment to free expression is not also easy. It's a core value of the university, but so too is being a community of belonging. And I have to tell you that in my world, and I suspect in everyone's world, the most challenging issues one faces are when there are the real or perceived conflicts between two deeply held values like these. And I want to be clear that from my perspective, there are often tensions, if not outright conflicts, between our commitment to free of siege and academic freedom on the one hand, and being a welcoming, just, and inclusive community on the other. I don't think it benefits anyone to pretend that that's not the case. But our responsibility as a university is to honor both commitments despite the tensions. Many of you may have seen the surveys that the Pew Research Center conducts on people's views about free expression. And what the data show is that students of college age are less likely to value the ability to speak freely than people who are older. And very unfairly, I believe, very unfairly, the response is that students are criticized for this. I don't think that's fair, because I know what they or you, if that's what you think, are responding to is the absolute accurate perception that when all speech, including highly offensive and even hateful speech, is tolerated, some groups of people will be more heavily impacted, notably, of course, the groups that historically have been marginalized in our society. And so it's not unreasonable to ask why we as a society permit this. Why don't we regulate speech to protect people from those groups against hateful expressions? So let me explain what I firmly believe, which is that free expression is absolutely fundamental to democracy, and that academic freedom is absolutely fundamental to higher education. Why? First of all, because you can't personally learn, and the state of knowledge as a whole can't advance if there isn't an opportunity for all sorts of ideas to be exchanged. Second, democracy only works when all citizens have the right to express their views so that they as a whole can shape the society in ways that they believe will benefit overall welfare. That's pretty much exactly what democracy means. Third, even when you end up disagreeing with another person's point of view, actively listening and, when warranted, responding sharpens your ability to reason, to communicate and convey your perspective, and, assuming it makes sense in a particular encounter, to negotiate and come up with a workable compromise. Democracy, and I would argue human relations in general, don't work without compromise. Now, this doesn't mean you always need to engage. It doesn't mean you always need to compromise with every speaker you encounter. You certainly can just abstain from attending talks by people who you are certain will do nothing but spout hateful ideas. And finally, and I think this one is really, really important, what history has shown us is that the harms caused by regulating speech almost inevitably end up hurting the most the very people the regulations were intended to protect. There are lots and lots of examples of this. Those of you in ILR will know about Eugene Debs, who was convicted of sedition for speaking out about American participation in World War I. Back in the 90s at the University of Michigan, I used to be at the University of Michigan, but this was before I got here, they attempted to put in place a student hate speech code. And the result were sanctions only against black students. Or look at what's happened with Colin Kaepernick when he tried to protest by taking in New York games. Indeed, true commitment to free expression is the only way to ensure that everyone's voice is heard, to ensure that historically minoritized voices are not left out. Although you have to work to ensure that. It's not just enough to say all voices are allowed. We have to ensure that that opportunity isn't denied for some groups. The importance of free speech is just so great that we have to protect it, even as we try to mitigate and manage the harms that sometimes cause us, because the harms of suppressing speech are even greater. So how do we do that? How do we as an institution try to mitigate that harm? How do we respond to truly hateful speech on our campus? Well, we can use our free speech rights as an institution to denounce truly hateful speech. Now, I want to be very careful here. We have to do that carefully and cautiously and not all the time. Because if we as administrators are too quick to call out speech as offensive, then we are putting ourselves right back into the position of judging and even regulating speech. But we're not completely muzzled, and in extreme cases, we can issue penalty speech. We can provide support, emotional, psychological, and other, to our students, while also helping them develop as leaders. We can employ bias response teams and alternative scripted resolutions and mechanisms like that, that when implemented carefully and without having a punitive component, do not abridge speech rights, but rather are an important part of our educational role. We have to remember that the right to free speech is not without limits. Harassment is not tolerated. Threatening speech is not tolerated. The heckler's veto, where one person shouts down the voice of another and effectively stops that person's right to free speech, is not allowed. Finally, before I conclude, I want to touch on the national situation where we're seeing attacks on free expression from both ends of the political spectrum. And I have to say that I find particularly troubling, especially troubling, legislative effects to do things like limit what can be taught in the classroom, and to limit access to books, threaten the institution of tenure, institute what are effectively educational gag orders. These are real threats on our right to seek, and these are things that we have to take seriously. Also, we're increasingly seeing what are essentially attacks on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in universities being couched as claims that universities don't support free speech. Now, if we were suppressing speech, if we were truly suppressing speech in an effort to protect people, then maybe this criticism would have some validity, but we're not. We're respecting free speech, and we're using our institutional right to free expression to communicate our commitment as a university to diversity, equity, and inclusion. None of this is simple. The lines aren't clean, so I want to go back to where I started, that the most challenging problems arise when there's a tension between deeply held values. We deeply value free expression and academic freedom. We deeply value diversity, equity, and inclusion. We need to find ways to honor both. And it's because of that, I don't know how many, probably nobody here reads the Cornell Chronicle, but if you did, you would have seen that it's because of that that we are planning next year to have a theme year focused on free expression. We want the whole community to engage with the significance and history and the challenges, the true challenges of free expression and academic freedom. The goal will be to increase knowledge about these topics and to provide opportunities for the development of skills that are just essential for effective participation in democracy. Active listening, leading controversial discussions, leading effective advocacy, managing one's responses to controversial interactions. We're planning a series of cornerstone events, such as reading groups on free expression, debates with invited speakers to model respectful dialogue, exhibitions that might span art, film, and fashion. Our academic units and departments and student organizations will be invited to organize events across our campus. Fairly soon, we'll be launching a website, and we're going to invite community members to share ideas. And later this month, when I have my annual breakfast with leadership of the assemblies and the faculty senate, we'll be discussing this further. I really, truly hope that we see broad participation around this critical issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, thank you for President Lombardi and President Pollack for coming and speaking with us today. And we'll do a short Q&A session just so that members of the assembly or community members can get a chance to ask you some questions. So any members of the assembly, you can raise your placards so I can call on you. Yeah, we'll begin with Trustee Wolda. You have the floor. Just make sure you speak into the mics.
Thank you guys both for coming out here today and speaking with us and providing updates. I wanted to discuss something that wasn't involved in the updates. So I'm sure you guys are aware, actually, the front page of the Daily Sun regarding the freshman who was held at gunpoint by CUPD due to a false call, I believe, and he was in his dorm at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he was traumatized by that because he already faced this from his home country, and I'm sure you guys remember during 2 years ago the CUPD disarmament campaign, and the main focus of the campaign was because marginalized students on campus feel unsafe with armed officers on campus, and this kind of proves that point. So I just want to know on your end what are updates with the community response team and public safety committee, and how can we as students and you as administration, how can we facilitate these conversations to see more strides so that way situations like this can't ever happen again? Yeah.
Sure, I can. Is this coming on? Okay. I'd be glad to start with that. I've been co-chairing PSAC, the Public Safety Advisory Council, this year in collaboration with Joanne DeStefano, so I can speak a little bit to some of the updates and where we're at with that. I want to back up a little bit to this incident as well. It was undoubtedly very scary for the individual involved. The police received a very concerning call that suggested that there was an active threat on the life of people living in that room, and so the police responded appropriately. Turns out that was a false call. Very scary for everybody involved, as you can imagine. And I think that this is, speaking of tensions, this is a tension exists, because if had that been accurate and there was, in fact, someone's life being threatened in there, we would have needed some type of response to hopefully end that or to mitigate that in some kind of safe way. Yet it was false, and then a student was very scared by that interaction at 4:30. We were all very scared by that interaction at 4:30 in the morning. So we have been working very, very hard. There is a new community response team. We're calling it kind of 2.0. There was one, as you might remember, a couple of years ago, so this is the second iteration of this. The leader of that has been hired, is in place, has actually been very active on campus. They are, interestingly, an update from the previous version. Now they have licensure in the state of New York, so they can, in fact, do many of the things that previously required a police officer to sign an order, let's say, for mental health support or some of those kinds of things, because now the CRT director is licensed and can do that themselves without engaging the police in any kind of those situations. That person's now building up a team, so that they have more support. Right now it's a person of one, but they'll be building a team over the summer so that we have a full team ready to go in the start of the fall semester. There have been a lot of student involvement in the PSAC this year, and I think it's been very helpful, and we'll be looking at membership for next year, and would certainly welcome if there's others who are involved. We always ask for a couple of folks from this body to be a part of that.
Thank you so much for your response. Do we have other questions on the floor? We'll go with Representative Everett. You have the floor.
Hello, President, Vice President. President Pollack, I just wanted to say I wholeheartedly agree with all the points you made about the importance of free speech here in school and especially around the country, especially with all of the legislature that's out that's prohibiting that across a lot of schools in America. I guess I just wanted a point of clarification regarding the resolution that was denied as to how the warning of triggering content prohibits the speech that is still going to be spoken, but is just forewarned for the students who may be traumatized by the content.
That's a very fair question. It's a very fair question. So I am not opposed in any way to a faculty member providing a notice that something is going to come up which may be challenging to some students. In fact, in my response, I note that often it would just be common courtesy to give that notice, and also sometimes often to contextualize why they're providing that. My objection, and what I think really does have a chilling effect and get in the way of free speech, is if you mandate that. So the resolution is urging that we mandate that we require faculty to provide content warnings across a broad range of topics. What happens in that situation is that faculty are afraid to speak because they know there's this requirement, and they're afraid that maybe there's something they haven't thought of, or maybe the conversation is veering in a new direction, and it really does limit and chill the right of the faculty in the classroom to have a free and open conversation. So we leave it up to, academic freedom says, we're going to leave it up to our faculty to behave in appropriate ways, and we're going to trust them to do what's right. And sometimes they're going to get it wrong, because that's life, you know, and that happens. But it's the mandate that, it's the requirement of trigger warnings that causes this problem. And actually, if you read the New York Times article on that, you see that Professor Humphreys makes really that same point.
Thank you for responding to that. We have other questions. We'll go with Representative Singh. You have the floor.
Hi, President Pollack, VP Lombardi. Thank you for being here today. My name is Claire Ting. I am one of the primary sponsors of Resolution 31. I wanted to first thank you for your thorough and prompt response. I've read and considered much of the criticism from both the response letter as well as the mentions surrounding free speech and free expression. And after much discussion, I can 100% agree that free speech and academic expression is something that needs to be honored and upheld. I'd like to provide a little bit of context as to where this resolution was born from. For reference, a community member, a recent victim of sexual assault, was made to read graphic scene-by-scene depictions of rape for a Korean-American literature class. Now, I understand that we agree that there is this middle ground that both the needs of the community and academic expression must be honored. And moving forward, I am more than open to creating a new solution to the needs of the community while still honoring this need. So from your end, I'd like to understand and perhaps even ask for some guidance as to how we can better facilitate this collaboration between students, faculty, and administration to honor this need.
Thank you for that. First of all, I did see somewhere, maybe it was a Daily Sun article where you reported that, and I want to make sure that student is getting the help that he or she needs that they know about the kind of support services we have for survivors of sexual violence, and also that they are going to CAPS if needed. Also, if they have a diagnosed case of PTSD, they really should be going to Students with Disability Services to ask for an accommodation. I think that if a student starts reading something like that and they find it very, very troubling, they should stop and go talk to the professor. I mean, that's sort of the simple answer. And if they're not comfortable going to the professor, then go to CAPS, go and find some trusted advisor to help them. Now, to your broader question, part of what we want to do in the coming year, a really important reason we're not, this isn't a one-and-done sort of issue. This is a really complicated issue. And what we want to do over the current year is work with the whole community to hash out these issues, to try and understand how we can grapple with this very challenging problem we have of supporting both these core values. And so what I would encourage is for you and whoever else in the assembly wants to get involved in planning this and thinking about the session groups or working groups are coming and talking with us, we are really welcoming.
I think all of those points are really good, and I would suggest we could help put you in touch with some faculty leadership, and maybe there could be some conversations that start to develop and talk about what not only programming could look like, but you know what recommendations could look like for faculty so they do feel equipped. But I think talking to faculty directly as a leadership body, the dean of the faculty would be a great place to start, Eve DeRosa, but probably some of her colleagues as well to help think through this challenging issue.
And I should quickly mention that just completely coincidentally, my once a semester visit to Faculty Senate was yesterday, and I had this same conversation with them, and they are very interested in participating in all the activities.
Thank you so much for responding to the questions. Do we have any on the floor? We'll go with Representative Gardwan.
President Pollack, VP Lombardi, thank you for coming and speaking with us. I'm sure you remember from the last time you spoke with the Student Assembly the concerns of the Basic Needs Coalition that were brought to your attention. To be quite frank, like any progress that we have made after regular meetings with administration has been like slow at best. And I wanted to see from like your perspective in the president's office, what are things that are being done to address the needs of like food insecurity, like homelessness? These are very real concerns for students who are allegedly receiving full and like adequate financial aid.
I'm going to let my colleague Eve Lombardi address this because it really falls very squarely in the story.
Yeah, so I have not gotten a lot of updates recently, I'll say that, but I know Dean Love is here in the audience and has been trying to meet with a group of folks, maybe yourself included, from the Basic Needs Coalition, and I know that some workshops and other steps were put into place for this semester, but I know there's also a lot that's in the hopes for the fall, so I apologize, I don't have those off the top of my tongue right here to share all those updates with you, but I'd be glad to have an additional conversation with you about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go with Representative Poole. We have the floor.
Thank you, President. Thank you both for being here. VP Lombardi, I was interested in something you had to say about the CRT. Do you know if they have any plans to transport 941 or 945 patients?
The CRT themselves won't make the transport, but they can sign the order for the transport because they're licensed. And so that's what's unique about this version of CRT versus a previous version. A student would still be transported likely via an ambulance or something along those lines or some other property, but they can sign the order, which wasn't something that they could do under the previous iteration. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you so much. Okay, we'll do a couple of more questions. We'll go with Representative Katie, you have the floor.
Hey, President Pollack, VP Lombardi, great to have you both here. I think it's been a very engaging conversation. Thank you for taking on a lot of our questions head on. Obviously, there's a lot of difficult topics being discussed here. I think I can speak for most assembly and say it's difficult for us as it is difficult to you to address. My question is specifically about engaging with the assemblies on really the kind of two issues that I think have centered most of our discussion, but primarily, or excuse me, on the one real issue behind most of this, I think, which is free expression and academic freedom around this. There seems to be a lot of questions brought up about drawing the line. There seems to be a lot of points made about the importance of preserving diversity and inclusion, as well as a lot of importance of including the perspective of students through this. We are the largest constituency on this campus, of course. We make up, you know, far more of its majority residents and faculty, staff, everyone. And our voices, we often feel like, though, don't represent that in every dialogue and every conversation. Understand that we are students, we're still learning. I get that. But my question is, what will this engagement look like with the assemblies in the future, going into this new theme, from either of your perspectives? And what can we say to students to feel like, especially after this recent resolution, even if there is understanding of ways to move forward together, how students' values and students' voices are still going to be prioritized and heard through that? Obviously, it's a complex issue, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, well, look, quite honestly, the theme here is something we've been talking about since January. We were getting ready to announce it, but we didn't quite have everything worked out, and then all of this came up, and so it seemed like the right time to announce it. What that means, and I'm going to be really honest here, is it's still in flux, it's still being developed. That's good for you, because you have a chance to help weigh in on this. So the next sort of milestone for the assembly to be involved will be at the leadership breakfast that you represent in UA will be at. So I would recommend that Valeria and you and the head of GPSA gather ideas, gather input, see what it is that would be helpful for you or that you would like to do. That will be the next checkpoint. As I say, we will also fairly soon have a website up, and we will invite input from the community.
I may add one thing here, and it's not necessarily focused on the free expression resolution, just resolutions in general. And I think in my time at Cornell, and I remember talking about this when I first got here, where I see more success is where some of the conversations around the different options or what's happening or what's not happening or what could happen, the hypotheticals, those taking place before the resolution to get a little more kind of homework or something like that on it can be really helpful to make sure that the resolution has the greatest chance for success. And I get that sometimes there's a time pressure, right? Like there's an expediency issue that probably you want to get a resolution out and kind of in front of this body or in front of the larger body. But when it's possible, I think when some of that work can happen ahead of time, I think that can be really helpful. I do think a recent example was the vending machine one. I think the group that put that together did an outstanding job of working with a number of different campus stakeholders. When it came through, a lot of that had already gotten done and taken care of, and then boom, it was, let's move it forward. And so I think that can be an example for that collaboration, and I hope that you would get receptivity from most of my colleagues, and I'd be happy to make introductions or pave the way or anything like that that I could be helpful in those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I do want to note is that even when we feel like we can't completely agree with the resolution, we do try to do what we can to be responsive. And so I think the resolution about the staff gynecologist is an example. We just literally do not feel like we can provide specialists at Cornell Health. We don't think we can hire such a person. But we heard the concern, and that's why we accelerated our plans to have more interaction with biopharma medicine. So I don't want you to feel like, you know, sometimes we can't accept something, that we don't hear you or we're ignoring you. We're doing the best to respond when it makes sense.
Thank you so much. We'll do two more questions. So we'll go with Representative Meharetsu on the Zoom. If you can unmute and ask your question.
So my question mainly pertains to where do we, to Resolution 31 in regards to how, I believe that everybody on this assembly agrees that free speech is something that should be protected and something that we talk about a lot. I feel like Claire can verify this, but they and I, we are constantly in spaces, and ILR, we're in spaces where there are people who are going to have opinions that disagree with us. These are normal. We do not try to stop people from sharing these opinions. We want to hear these opinions so we can come to a compromise. But Resolution 31 wasn't a resolution about limiting free speech. It was a resolution protecting minority students. Before you mentioned that minority students were disproportionately impacted by such actions of limiting such speech, which in cases of limiting speech, this is a very serious action. That's not what we were asked for. We asked for speaking on these issues. We're not calling for a Eugene B. We're not asking like Eugene B. Debs trying to stop a specific course being taught. We're talking about students seeing traumatic imagery in their courses. I've had conversations with minority students, with multiple students who have talked about this, who have asked for this, and we had two wonderful students come up here and present that resolution, asking for trigger warnings. These are warnings, not full indictments of the literature that is being taught. If it comes down to it, we're not saying that professors should be limiting the content of their work. If individuals don't feel that the content reflects anything that they want to learn, they can always leave the course, drop the course, or anything of that nature. We're saying in courses where we're not expecting, say, the body of the lynched man, or reading passages of detailed sexual assault experiences. This, I genuinely don't know where the where the restraint is coming from. I just want to ask, where would the line be drawn in the case of protecting our students and protecting speech? Because if we're truly talking about it, can we really say that we're protecting the students by protecting their speech when we're having them look at traumatic imagery, when we're having them relive traumatic experiences such as being frisked and stopped by cops, seeing traumatizing images, being told horrible stories about experiences that we faced firsthand, secondhand, and things that continue to cause trauma within minority communities. I would just like to ask, where do we draw the line of protecting free speech and protecting the minds of our students?
I have to say, first of all, I'm not sure that it was really hard to hear you, and I'm not sure I understood every word, but I got the gist of the question. So let me, I'm at the risk of repeating a little of what I said. This is a very complex issue, and it's not an issue that I'm going to be able to do justice to in 3 or 4 minutes. I do think there needs to be discussion. This is sort of orthogonal to everything I've said so far, but we actually need to look at the scientific literature on trigger warnings, because it's not even clear that they are effective. But that is actually a separate issue for another day. What I think we need to do, and we can do this through the discussions next year, is try to understand why it is that when you try to put these protections in place, what happens is that they backfire. And what happens in this case is, if you're telling faculty you must provide these warnings, faculty are going to shy away from all kinds of conversations that are really important to your education. And what's going to happen is that when conversations go in unexpected ways and a warning hasn't been issued, things are going to shut down. It does lead to a chilling of free speech. It does lead to a chilling of the expression. And that's why we're putting it in place. But I realize that in this 1 minute, I'm really not getting at, I'm sort of just repeating what I already said, and I want to again encourage that what we do over the next year as a community of scholars is to interrogate these issues and grapple with them and try to get deeper understandings about them.
Okay, now I'll open it up to any community members if you have any questions that you want to ask. If you can just come to the mic right here and then just state your name so that we can all hear you. Yeah, the mic in that corner.
President Pollock, BP Lombardi.
Be closer to the microphone so we can hear you.
My name is Muti, and as an international student, one of the things that drew me to Cornell, on top of the statistics, that Cornell took pride in its international student population and preaching for diversity and other things along those lines. It's not only evident in the number of international students here, but I think the area studies program and the effort that the Office of International Admissions put to support students in applying. I was very grateful for that. But upon arriving here, and from my observations in conjunction with having conversations with my peers, I noticed that while there's no question about the horizontal diversity of Cornell, that's referring to the nationalities represented and whatnot, I think the same couldn't be said about the vertical diversity here. Speaking to the socioeconomic backgrounds of international students, we noticed that wasn't so diverse. And I might be wrong here, but I think that's reaffirmed in a lot of the statistics. So I raised that question to some of my peers in the student assembly, and we identified that Cornell's need aware policy towards international students is definitely a contributing factor to that. So we've begun the drafting of a resolution, but my question is that why has Cornell switched to being a need aware school in 2017? Because before that it was need blind.
So I can answer that. I came here in 2017, but this was already underway. First of all, I would love it. I would totally love it if we could be need blind with respect to international students. The fact of the matter is we can't afford it. We don't have the money for it. International students don't get U.S. grants, and so each international student is actually much, much more expensive. When we were need blind, we could not guarantee that we would meet full need for international students. So for domestic students, we guarantee need-blind admissions and then a package of grants and loans and work study to cover costs. We weren't doing that before I got here. Again, I wasn't involved in these decisions, so it's just, but I support it. We weren't doing that. And so students would come from abroad. They'd been admitted on a need-blind basis, but they didn't have enough aid to live. And it was just not fair to them. We were putting them in a terrible situation. So we went to a policy where we were need-blind up to the point at which we had no more funds. But then instead of saying, well, we won't just take any more international students, we then became need aware so that we can continue to meet international students. Now, we are trying to raise more money from many of our international donors like to contribute to this, but we just honestly cannot afford to be blind with respect.
Would it be okay if I ask
a follow-up question?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to pull up the numbers here, but I can't. So could you clarify a little bit more on regarding the process of like funds and supporting international students? Because as I understand it, Cornell's endowment is just shy of $10 billion compared to some other Ivy League institutions that do have need-blind policies towards international students. Take Brown and Dartmouth, for example. They have a few billion dollars less than us. And also to your point about ensuring that whatever international students we accept, we need full their full demonstrated need. We, as international students, we still have to pay a 14% international student tax. Airfare return home isn't guaranteed, even if everything's met. And in comparison to some other Ivy League institutions, such as Princeton, airfare is guaranteed, tax is paid for. So I'd just like clarification on those.
Yeah. Points. So first of all, on the endowments, what you need to look at is not just the endowment, but the endowment per student. We're a much bigger university. Princeton, I forget, Princeton is like, what is it, 20 times? I mean, the endowment per student, look at Princeton's endowment and divide by the number of students. It's orders of magnitude larger than ours. Princeton has way more money. Same thing with Dartmouth. We provide the best packages that we can. If we were to add things like airfare home, then we'd have to admit even fewer international students. I mean, it's really always just a balancing act of trying to balance all of our resources. And as I say, we're working hard to raise more money for this. It is a priority, but we simply cannot afford to do it at this point.
Thank you. And with that, we have already kept you here over time, so we'll end questions there. But as always, you can reach out to me or Jessica in the office of Assembly to connect with our president and vice president. So thank you again.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Enjoy the web.
Okay. Continuing on to our agenda, we have our consent agenda. So we have the March 30th meeting minutes. So if you haven't taken a look at those, take a look at them now. And I welcome any motions to amend or to approve.
Motion to approve the March 30th meeting minutes by unanimous consent.
Second.
Okay. There was a motion. There was a second. Do we have any dissent? No? Oh. Seeing no dissent, the March 30th meeting minutes have been approved unanimously. We are now moving on to open microphones, so I will pass it on to Vice President Amberg for this section.
Hello, everyone. Open microphone at the time that any community member can come up and say any concerns they have. So they would like, you're all going to come up here. No? Okay. Closing open microphone.
Thank you, Vice President Amberg. So now we are in announcements and reports. Do we have any announcements on reports? We'll begin with our Director of Elections. Who will you have the floor?
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say I'd like to echo President Pollock's words on the unfortunate passing of the first-year child biology student, Maddie Friedman. And I just wanted to say I'm sorry for anything personally. And I'd like to say that I'd like to take this time for the community to heal and also just to kind of process this information. And in light of that, the Elections Committee has decided to halt campaigning for the next week. So effective immediately, the campaigning will be paused until Thursday, April 20th. Anyone found to have continued campaigning during this period, whether that be online or in person, may be found to be breaking election rules and even disqualified from running. So we view this as just a means of letting the community take some time to heal and come together. So if you have any questions about what that entails or any specific questions, feel free to reach out to me or just talk to me after the meeting. But I just wanted to just
thank you for that. Okay. We'll move on to other announcements. So we'll go with representative team. You have the floor.
Not an announcement, sorry. Is it all right if I ask a follow-up question to
go ahead.
So regarding the halting of campaigning, first of all, thank you so much for keeping that in consideration, and I hope again that you may have time
to speak closer to the microphone.
Sure. I was wondering if there's a possibility that we can make an announcement of such, and are we going to promote this on Instagram and other platforms?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this up as soon as the first thing a little ago, shortly after the convention of this meeting, and I said we will be posting on Instagram to bring this information to
us. We'll go with Sam.
Thank you, Rahul. I'm wondering if, in regards to that, if we already have campaign materials posted, if we need to take those down during this week.
So anything that's already up can remain up. You just can't add anything new. You can't meet with clubs and ask for endorsements, anything like that, in light of what happened. Representative Chatterjee, how's it going?
I just want to say thank you for that. Matt was like a buddy of mine, so I mean, I think it's a really great decision you've made. So thank you for that.
Representative Maharetsu on Zoom, you have the floor.
Today I just wanted to give a quick report on the Office of Federal Relations, D.C. office. Students from Cornell went to D.C. for Advocacy Day to advocate for an increase in financial aid. Some of the topics that were talked about were increasing the Pell Grant from $6,000 it is now to $13,000. Again, these aren't promises or anything. There was no promise or anything made like that. It was just Congress people hearing us and us talking about possible next steps. Another thing that we talked about was the increase of financial aid for federal work study students. At least in terms of federal work study, it's become a serious issue with students running out of money for their federal work study. And through this increase, it will ease that burden on students. Another thing that came up was a possible path to citizenship, advocating for a possible path to citizenship for DACA students, as well as allowing eligibility for DACA students, allowing DACA students to be eligible for federal financial aid. Currently, federal, in terms of DACA students, they don't receive federal financial aid. Cornell uses grants to subsidize the stress put, the financial stress put on these students, and it puts many burdens on these students, and it isn't very effective. Or effective to the degree that it could be, through advocating for this, through the advocating of allowing federal DACA students to receive federal. I'm sorry, y'all. I was in like 15 different meetings today. I'm so tired. But this would pretty much just allow DACA students to receive federal aid. There are many other topics that were talked about, including basic needs. With many of these, with many representatives showing support, we met with Ithaca's Representative Mark Molinaro, met with Senator Schumer's staff. We didn't meet with Molinaro, we met with staff. We met with everybody's staff. But it was a very interesting conversation. And I definitely recommend for students to.
Thank you for that announcement, Representative Maharetsu. So we have any last announcements on the floor? Trustee Wanda, you have the floor. And just make sure you speak into the mic so you can all hear.
Hi, everyone. My name is Salam Moldai. I don't have a placard here right now. I just wanted to say that for those that are unaware, 2 years ago, I was one of the organizers for the CUPD disarmament campaign. So the recent events is something that I feel very strongly, very passionate about. And I do plan to follow up with the Public Safety Committee and as well as CRT to see what they do plan to ensure that incidents like this do not happen again. And I just want to put this out there if anyone's interested in working on this with me. My net ID is SW685 and my Instagram is Salam B Trustee. So yes, just want to put that out there.
Thank you for bringing up Trustee Wolfgang. Okay, we'll go with Representative Bardwatch. You have the floor.
I just have a follow-up question for Chairperson Verma. I know that I'm very glad that campaigning is going to be paused, and I wanted to clarify none of the election dates and everything are going to be changed, right? So there should just be like the week of campaigning before the election.
As far as any election dates up now, they shouldn't be changed with the continuation of the campaign or the candidate forum for general members of the Senate is still going on the 20th, but up until then, we're still struggling on the campaign.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you have any last announcements? Floor and Zoom. Okay. We'll move on to initiatives. Do we have any on the floor? Representative Katie, you have the floor.
Hey, everyone. Most of you remember Resolution 28, Protecting the Right to Protest, which was a conversation, which is a resolution that was passed here. I pulled it up. We passed it on the 16th of March. The University Assembly was introducing an identical version that has now been amended to kind of change the context a little bit and strengthen it. It's currently open for public comment. The public comment section was extended. I know that it's passed this assembly. I know there's a lot of people in the community curious of supporting kind of how this line is drawn. And I think part of this resolution is really relevant to our conversation with President Pollack about having students involved in that process, having our assemblies involved in the process. If you're interested, the University Assembly one is still being voted on and there's room for comments. I'd highly encourage anyone who feels very strongly about this initiative to comment on that. Thank you. It's on the Assembly's website.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Do we have any other initiatives on the floor? Soon? No. Okay. We'll move on to presentations and forums. There aren't any on the agenda, and now we're at it late. So we'll skip over to business of the day, which we also don't have, and nothing was added late. So now we are on new business. So first up, we have Resolution 35, amending the Student Assembly bylaws. So can my co-sponsors join us on the floor? And this resolution is printed for you, so I shouldn't be seeing any computers, any phones, any side chatter. Make use of your hard copy, and let's pay attention to our presenters.
All right. Hello, everyone. This has been a long time coming, but we are amending the Student Assembly bylaws and charter. This resolution amends the Student Assembly bylaws to give more guidance to the operations SA Environmental Committee when collaborating with other committees. So I'm not sure if I should read what's already in the charter, but it's basically listed right here at 10 through 11, or 10 through 26. But then, skipping to line 27, he had finally resolved after line 342, the following addition should be added to give guidance to the SA Environmental Committee. The Environmental Policy and Planning Commission should coordinate and report their operations to the Campus Sustainability Office. And then the next amendment is going to come, it's listed in the bylaws from lines 378 to 395. And then skipping down to line 55 of this resolution, be it finally resolved after line 395, the following addition should be added to give guidance to the SA Environmental Committee when collaborating with SAIMC. The Student Assembly Infrastructure Fund Commission should consult and collaborate with the Campus Sustainability Office on projects related to sustainability. Additionally, the Student Assembly Infrastructure Fund Commission should consult and collaborate with the Campus and Community Engagement and or the Dean of Students Office on long-term projects. Be it finally resolved, the Student Assembly adopts these changes to better help collaborating and give guidance to the Environmental Policy Committee. Respectfully submitted, Robert.
Thank you so much for presenting. And as a reminder, this is a bylaws amendment, so we'll discuss it now and then we'll vote on it next week. With that said, we're in the debate. So Representative Clancy, your faculty district, you have the floor.
Hey there. So I am currently the chair of the Environmental Committee, and just a little bit of a timeline for everyone. As of January, we had, I believe, 13 or 14 people on the committee, and since then, it is back to me, and that is because the major issue with the Environmental Committee is that a lot of the insight and research that we want to do to support these policies simply can't be supported with our yearly budget of $25. So in collaboration with the SAIFC, is anything in this resolution going to help support basically just the ability for us to do our job so that we can help you do your job?
That is something I did not know. The bylaw resolution basically came out of amending the charter and then them wanting to like implement these things to clarify projects going forward. And then when I realized it wasn't the charter, it was a separate resolution. But at least with the budget of $25, hopefully that is like resolved by the fact that you guys can collaborate more with SAIFC, and that SAIFC funding could be used in collaboration really on sustainability. So I think that's sort of the goal here is to like pipeline the money that way for those projects. They should guess.
That's good. Thank you.
Do you have any comments? Representative Baker, you have the floor.
This is a question for you. Why isn't the Environmental Policy and Planning Commission on the SA budget?
The committee, the Environmental Committee?
Yeah. Why doesn't any of the SA internal budget go to that?
It could. I think we just, so the way we did the budget, if you remember last semester, we didn't have a VP of finance because we were in the midst of replacing one, the design, it was kind of a mess. So what we did, we just got the same budget that we had last year and we used the same one, which included the $25 for the Environmental Policy and Planning Committee. Representative Baker?
Okay, well then, just a suggestion for Representative Kalinske and DeLorenzo. Maybe you guys could draft a resolution amending the SA budget to give this committee some more money so that Representative Kalinske can do more with it before the end of the semester.
Do you have any other comments, questions? Motions, you also need a motion. We want to continue. Representative Kalinske, you have the floor.
Motion to move into voting.
So it's motion to postpone to next week since it's a bylaw amendment.
Motion to postpone to next week.
Okay, there
was second.
What's up, by unanimous consent?
Yes.
Okay, there was a second. Do we have any dissents? Okay. So resolution 35, amending the student assembly bylaw since they're postponed to next week. Unanimously. And continuing on to Resolution 36, amending the Student Assembly Charter. It's also printed out for you, so you shouldn't look at any electronics. And it's the same co-sponsor, so you have the floor again.
Okay, so Resolution 36, amending the Student Assembly Charter, basically came out of last year, Resolution 59, and President Pollock gave her feedback on that. And so this is really the update to the charter to better, you know, help organize organizations to their funding. So this resolution amends the Student Assembly Charter to standardize the reporting guidelines and funding structure for each byline, further classify bylines based on their organization's operations, and promote the collaboration between different byline organizations. So hopefully, I'm not sure like how we want to do this, if I should read through all 9 pages of this. Okay. So I'll give like the high level overview, and then we can basically field questions after that. So essentially, in the current way that the Appendix B Section 4 organization specific guidelines are set, not all the bylines are actually listed within that part of the charter. And so there are some bylines missing, and then there are some bylines there. The bylines that are there all have different requirements based on their specific byline. And in terms of, like, you know, organizational operations, it creates a lot of confusion and unnecessary, you know, planning and reporting that these advisors have to do in the end. So as a result, they're dedicating their, you know, more of their time to reporting other than actually doing what their byline and the organization should be doing. So this, in the long run, right, our goal is to kind of create a standardized employees, because there are still some stipulations that are left in here, but it's mainly to take out some of the nonsense requirements and make it so that these bylines can breathe, they have the room to operate how they want to do so. The next major change here is the classification of these bylines into 4 different buckets. The first bucket is departmental, and so this one is basically where they have a office-ish that they report to or coordinate with, and they're supposed to basically, that office is supposed to help and support that. And so by this I mean it's currently out of the bylines in the student in the charter, right? There's only 3 that are actually classified as departmental because they're only handled by departments, but the department classification now will extend to all the organizations that still have associations with different offices on campus. So a good example of this is the Office of Emergency Management, CUEMS. So under this, CUEMS will be classified as a department byline with Office of Emergency Management, but still be run by the students within that organization. The next major bucket is programming, and this is something exciting that Campus Activities has been working on for a while to create the Programming Council. The Programming Council consists of, I believe it's between 10 to 12 of these byline organizations that their main goal is to basically put on programming events for the students. And the benefit here is that if the Programming Council were to be formed, these organizations in the future would be able to share resources that they currently have. And so a big thing that obviously I'm sure you guys have seen online, you see on SideChat, is the Slip Day Committee and the struggles that they've had this year. But with this new classification system of the Programming Committee, hopefully in the future, Slip Day will be able to have access to the resources that they want based on the allocation of other programming byline organizations within that funding. The next major classification is the primary funding boards, and these are SAFC, Interfaith, and Club Sports Council, and these are the primary funding organizations that fund the groups beneath them. There were some issues this past year of how some organizations, they would be, you know, for example, just coming off the top of my head, like let's say you're on the rugby team, and the rugby team doesn't want to do all the requirements of Club Sports Council. What the rugby team would opt to do is then be reclassified under SAFC. But in reality, like, you are a club sports team, you should be under the Club Sports Council. So this is really where that distinction comes into place and says that if you receive money from SAFC, you're no longer eligible to receive money from Club Sports Council. Another benefit here is that all 3 of those councils will have a funding tier system that does not exceed $8,000 for organization per academic year. And for the primary funding boards, they also offer supplementary budgets that can't exceed more than $5,000 per semester per student organization. So that's for Club Sports Council, that's their tournament fund, for SAFC events or special events fund, and things like that. And then the last main bucket is the supplementary funding boards, which are all the other organizations and bylines that fund organizations and help fund organizations under SAFC, but they can also do some of their own programming. And so this really just gives them the leeway to allocate the money how they want to, as well as put on events and program throughout. I think besides like those high level changes that we hope to make, all of this stuff is, I think it'll help streamline the byline funding process in the future, and it'll help create a better community. But I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you for, number one, doing all this work. I know working with Appendix C is a lot, so thank you for that. But with that said, we'll open it up to debate. Any questions? Okay, we'll begin with Representative Bardwaj. You have the floor.
This is a question more for you, President Valencia, because I know that you're also the president of Alana. It says here that McFab is not included under the Alana organizations, and I know that there's been like some like confusion as to if it is actually an Alana organization or not. So I was just curious if like as like moving forward, like McFab might be included.
Yeah, so I'll let VP De Lorenzo answer that.
I was going to say, neglected to say that change. In this new structure, because McFad primarily puts on concerts and events, they'd be basically pulled out of Alana, but under the programming council, and then they'd be able to share synergies among all the other concert commissions that plan events and things like that there. For this next year, the expectation is that whatever money was allocated to McFab within Alana, the Alana allocation would be reduced proportionate to what the McFab one would be, so the funding was reduced.
Yeah, and then for some more background, like McFab has always been really independent. Like, we don't oversee them or anything. They just got funded through us, and this is a little more streamlined. But okay, do you have any other comments, questions, concerns? Representative Katie, you have the floor.
Thank you for all the hard work here. I know Appendix C is very complicated, very difficult to work through. From even just like half the semester I did in appropriations, it's difficult. My kind of interest is, and I, this might just be totally wrong here, but would there be room for if expanding orgs into the byline for recategorization? What's your kind of perspective on that, and how would that process affect these photos here? So say, for example, Cornell Minds Matters, an organization hypothetically wants to get involved in the same space, and the student assembly feels there's room and capacity to support them as well. If there's some sort of integrated mission where they feel like their byline allocations or their finances should be interconnected, does that create issues with departments? What does that look like? Or am I kind of reading this wrong? Which also could be valid, because I'm self-admitting and not as versed in this as some people.
Yeah. So Cornell Minds Matter.
And that's just you, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So I'll basically give the rundown this way, at least how I think the back end works. Is that, you know, for let's say like the Office of Emergency Management, CUDMS, the money that CUDMS gets is put into a separate account other than Office of Emergency Management, and under this new system, that account won't exist, so that money would go to Office of Emergency Management, and people still be sure to get it. So I believe that's how it works. It's basically just meant to simplify like the process on the back end and the budgets, everything. And I know a lot of people at campus activities, experiments, the dean of students that are looking forward to systems.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. So just clarifying, that would then mean expanding the bylaws and or adding new organizations here would also just be falling under that same streamlined process.
It would, I think, okay, like let's say we have an organization come up in the future and their mission pairs well with a pre-existing office. I feel like that student assembly in the future can make that differentiation. Because you know, the way I see it is that like, if another organization, like let's say Cornell Minds Matter, they come up, Cornell Minds Matter under this circumstance here would be overseen by the Sporting Center. And so their mission would kind of put them there. It also helps out if you think of like legal risk management, what they can and can't do. That was something that years were into last year as well.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. I would see that like in the future, like the way a programming one might bubble up is if they capped out SAOC to a limit and then run it to jump. That, yeah, I think that's the main goal. So I think moving on from this section, there's another thing at the very end that I want to highlight right now. So if you go to line 317 in this resolution, 33, so it says, whereas lines 348 to 353 of the SA Charter Appendix B, to receive byline funding, applicants must directly and primarily serve the benefit of the entire undergraduate community, allow all students equal access to service and or participation, to request as part of their annual operating budget at least 50 cents per student per year from the student activity fee, and if a new applicant present a petition of 1,500 registered undergrad students. So then finally resolve the changes that we want to add in there to that section. Section 3 would be the following would be inserted after line 353 of the SA Charter. B, of university status and have an advisor who is provided by the university to advise the operations of the organization, have been a pre-registered university organization and be in good standing with campus activities, and be in the top tier of their current primary funding board, means that they have outgrown the primary funding board model and thus are seeking a higher level of recognition from the board.
Thank you. Do we have any other comments, questions, or concerns? Okay, before that, I do have a question. So I'm wondering if, like, given all these changes, or it's obviously very many, have you been in communication with the Byline orgs themselves to see what they're thinking of these changes?
So as of now, there have been a few that have reached out and asked for, after the appropriations committee, like, if you reach out and say, hey, like, these requirements we have in the current charter, can we take them out for next year? I've communicated with them that we are making these changes, but as of now, like, byline-wide, I have not done that yet. I think that, like, I want to be clear is that nothing within these bullet points, like, underneath the ones, besides the overseeing and helps admin by, like, whatever office, nothing has been added in here as a stipulation. So we're only really taking stipulations out. I can reach out to them if you've been to that mess, but I have a feeling that they'd be able to do this as well.
Yeah, I would just say, like, from past experience, right, whenever you're making these changes, you do want to have the violence involved in the conversation, so they're not blindsided with a whole new set of charter fee that they haven't seen before. So I think take this time from this week to the next to reach out to them and see what they tell you. Yeah, just so they're still in the loop. But okay, we'll do two more questions. We'll go with Representative Kuehl.
Thank you, Representative DeLorenzo. I'm wondering if you think that lines 328 through 334, do you think that adding those will inhibit the ability of new organizations from receiving larger amounts of funding than they otherwise would be able to? And if so, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Or what are your thoughts?
Okay, so this was something, if you notice, like, within the primary funding boards, they're going to have a standardized cap of $8,000. The minimum student assembly allocation is 50 cents on the byline. And so 50 cents times 1,500 students is $7,500. So the goal here is to basically say that if you are an undergrad student organization, in order to qualify for byline funding, you need to cap out that tier within SAFC or Interfaith or Club Sports Council and then apply to get byline. So it's instead of this, $4,000 worth of funding.
You speak closer to the mic, which sounds.
Instead of, like, an organization, like, let's say they get $4,000 worth of funding, they can't just jump up to that minimum $7,500 worth of funding. They're going to have to show their need within their primary funding board. Organization that they're under. So, in my opinion, I don't think it will inhibit these violent organizations from being able to receive funding in the future. I think that it will incentivize organizations to work up within the tiers within SAFC, Interfaith, and Club Sports Council. And, I mean, that's something that SAFC has been working on, right? In order to qualify for their top-tier funding and their new SAFC reforms, you're going to have to attend like workshops on DE&I, as well as treasurer, as well as officer switchovers and things like that. So I think in the end, these are very, very good changes, and they won't hurt the bylaws.
Lovely. Thank you, Lovely.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll go with Representative Vice President Acevedo. You have the floor.
Actually, I'll withdraw my motion because Representative Bardwaj and
okay. So Representative Bardwaj will be our last speaker for this resolution. You have the floor.
I also have a question about like the concert, the funding board is supposed to be to have like all the slope day, like all of those, like the programming board. Are they allowed to share funds also on this like new like advisory council, or is it just that they'll be able to like support each other and like advertising events and making sure that they don't conflict and things like that?
Yes. So essentially the way that it's the goal is to have it be set up is to have all of the ones that primarily do programming under one basically umbrella organization. They're just not a primary funding board. The programming council is basically going to be run like an organization where you have all like their presidents of the organizations that come to the like, president's meeting, and then you also have like an exec board of this programming council. I think the goal in the end is that next year, without these restrictions and classifying them under one roof, they will be able to share funding, which in my opinion is good for some of these organizations, especially because some of them do have rollover, right? And so instead of that rollover going into their organization's account, they'll be able to help the Cornell community with things just because of how expensive things have gotten there and things that people have said and released online about that. They really were in a tough spot this year, but I think that they definitely did the best they can for the to go on a slope day as well. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And with that, we need a motion actually to continue. Vice President Acevedo.
Yeah, I apologize. I don't know where my placard is, but a motion to postpone to next week.
What's the motion? Is there a second?
Second.
Is that by unanimous consent?
Yes.
Do we have any dissent? Seeing no dissent, Resolution 36, amending the Student Assembly Charter, has been postponed till next week, where we will debate it more and then vote. Okay, moving on to our agenda, we have Resolution 37, which is calling for Cornell University to implement need-blind admissions for all international students. So can the co-sponsors join us in the center of the floor? And again, this resolution is printed, so no computers, no phones, and also no side chatter, so that we can all be present and in the room. With all of that said, our co-sponsors, you have the floor, so whenever you're set up and ready, you can go right ahead.
So I just want to start off the presentation with two quick points. I want to the first point is I would want to challenge the representatives here that have heard the comments made by President Polak on the issue of Cornell's current policy of need-blind admission, and to hopefully also inform both sides of the current debate on why the current need-blind policy is. And also Moody and various members of the International Students Affairs Committee hopefully present also their side of why they feel that it is necessary to also reconsider the stance currently employed by the university. And the second point is I'd like to refer back to the fact that the International Student Affairs Committee was approved this semester and already has gotten up and already has a resolution on the floor. And I do think that this is a prime example of what a well-oiled student assembly committee and what the overall organization can look like, and I just want to say that I'm very proud of the work that we have done. So without further ado, Moody will talk a little bit more about the details, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, before you begin, just make sure you really speak into the mic. The chimes annoy, so you cannot hear you.
I'll try my best.
That's good.
But I think everyone has access to it, so we can all read it, but I'd just like to point out a few of the most shocking statistics that I've come across in the research. That's Firstly, like, as I already mentioned to Professor Pollock, I raised Brown and Dartmouth as comparisons, but it's not just them. If we look at all across all the other Ivy Leagues and R1 institutions, which Cornell likes to hold its name next to, they all employ need-blind policy towards international students. And I understand President Pollock's point about budget and money, but I'd like to address that shortly. The other statistic, speaking of diversity, is that in the latest report by our Office of Global Learning, 10 nationalities out of 116 represent 78.6% of the international student population. I think those numbers speak for themselves. And if we oppose, let's say, low income, generally speaking, a low income areas to higher income areas, like I just picked Africa and Europe as examples, 53.7% of African nations were represented, whereas 93.2% of European nations were. I think that says something. We also requested statistics regarding the amount of international students who are receiving financial aid and the type of financial aid they receive, and unfortunately they didn't get back to us in time for this hearing, but once we have those statistics, we hope to amend the resolution further. So essentially what we call upon is for Cornell to implement need-blind policies. That's the only thing we're calling upon. And based on President Pollock's response, it seems that Cornell is saying they can't because there's not enough money to do so. But honestly, I see it as them balancing a tightrope. On one hand, they won't go to a need-blind policy because they want to ensure that every international student they accept, they're able to offer a financial aid package that would ensure them no worries whatsoever regarding trying to pay tuition and whatnot. On the other hand, if she goes to need-blind policy, she can't do the same for international students. But I don't want to invalidate her argument or anything along those lines, but taking into account the 14% tax that international students have to pay, that's not covered by the school. And as you may have noticed, I raised both that and airfare term, and she only focused on airfare. The 14% tax still falls on the shoulders of international students. I have a friend from Afghanistan who was given a full financial aid package, but he was still expected to pay the tax, and he couldn't. So he's expected to come up with that on his own somehow. And if the school already deems that you can't pay a single dollar for school, where are you expected to get $4,500 to pay for the taxes from? So I just—it's either one or the other. It's either you keep a need. I think the school should either keep a need-aware policy and actually ensure 100% of all expenses are covered, or go to a need-blind policy and revert back to its pre-2017 status.
I also just want to point out a few things. First of all, the clause 29 through 31. So like Moody just mentioned, there are various Ivy League universities that practice needs-blind policy. For example, Brown is currently in the transitional progress, like in the traditional stage into adopting a need-blind policy. Dartmouth as well has been recent to also converting to a need-blind policy. Most of these other universities are in the, like in the Ivy League especially, are in the process of or have recently completed the process of a needs-blind admission, which goes to show that there is currently like movement. It is a movement to, you know, supporting, you know, international students and their right, you know, any person, any study, in calling for Cornell to uphold that. But initially, I also want to just back up the point that Moody just mentioned about the 14% tax, which this assembly has seen through Resolution 9 already this year, discussing the 14% tax. I believe Brown, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Moody, for first years provide, like, they cover the cost of the tax. So what really this resolution is about is two things. One, calling for like more of a long-term like put like nudging in the direction of adopting needs blind policy. But also this resolution here, this piece of paper, is more of a framework. The reason why the International Student Affairs Committee came to the student assemblies in order to get an initial round of support, because there are various offices and that work with international students affairs, like Cornell admin offices, that have expressed support for, you know, this initiative and for hopefully adopting a needs blind policy in the future. And so hopefully in the span of the next week or two, from the next university assembly meeting, the ISAC is hopefully hoping to get more statistics, more statements of support from all across, you know, student body, but also Cornell academic, you know, directors itself. And so hopefully we can have an extremely coherent facts-based argument to present to, you know, hopefully the university assembly. And the reason why we are also presenting here is just also in terms of like a time frame issue as well. And so we would love to get any thoughts from the general student assembly body, but also to hopefully get the support and the endorsement of the idea through. Yeah.
So given all the voices, we'll do a 1 minute timer for questions and then 1 minute for responses. But with that, we'll begin with Representative Yang. You have the floor. Can you speak into the microphone?
Like, I think it's a really great proposal, and I'm also an international, but like, however, there's a problem. It's just not practical, especially in the circumstances as the president just announces. Like, our enrollment for students is not comparable to other average students. So like, actually, I'm optimistic about this proposal, and I think this proposal could be implemented later, like in the next few years, but I don't think that this is the time. Also, like Cornell is not entirely a private, also partly a public. It has several Kentucky colleges, and so like the Cornell University actually has obligation to give education to the citizens.
That's time.
Okay, in New York.
You have 1 minute to respond.
Understand that point and our resolution, just because we go to a need blind policy doesn't mean that every single international student has to have all their expenses covered. It just means that they should make sure that every single student that gets admitted that needs that like gets 100% offer actually that lives up to that in terms of taxes and airfare and whatnot. Or you move to a need blind policy and admit more international students at a greater diversity with like respective to how much money you can offer them in terms of aid. It's like pick one or the other, you know what I mean?
Thank you for that. Okay, we'll go with Representative Mitchell Foy, you have the floor, you also have 1 minute.
Hey, thanks, guys. I was wondering, I've read through the resolution, and I'm wondering if you could dumb it down for a rockhead like me. What is need blind exactly, and why is it so important that international students be considered need blind?
So this might exceed a minute. Essentially, if a school is need blind, then in reviewing your application, your ability to contribute financially will not be a part of it. Whereas if it's need aware, you get admitted or declined with considerations to your ability to contribute. So for example, if like, let's say an international student applies and Cornell really wants them, but unfortunately they've already exercised most of their funds, or they believe there's a candidate that's of equal capability that can contribute more financially. So there's where the disadvantage comes from. As you can see, students from a more economically developed country, on average, would have an advantage in this.
That was perfect. Thank you so much.
Yeah, okay. We'll go with Representative Swanson. You also have 1 minute.
Thank you, guys. So I just have a few friendly amendments, take it or leave it.
I think line two doesn't serve any purpose. I think line 11, you need a site where you got that it discourages low-income international students. Line 12 is good because it's pretty obvious. And then I'd strike line 33 and 34 because Martha Pollock kind of debunked that myth of how it's endowment per student, so, right? But, like, if this gets to her desk and she sees this, she'd be like, I just talked about this. I literally debunked it, right? So I think you're asking, I think you need to emphasize, like, how Brown's transitioning into this, into these sentiments. Pedro, you said that already. And the big part, if you want to win anything, I think a big win would be 57 and 58 by changing the title to something new. Because when she sees the title, she's going to be like, no. That's what I'd say. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 1 minute to respond.
Sorry, can you repeat the last one?
I think you should change the title because she's going to read that and be like, no, as she already said. So I'd include something about releasing statistics regarding financial aid recipients because that's very, very important and that would benefit all students.
Thank you.
Comment on that. Yeah, JP, that was really productive. I actually really, really appreciate it. I also really appreciate Union also as well. All the feedback is, like, super duper helpful, so, like, thank you guys.
So that wasn't a motion, but did you want it to be, or was that just a comment to them?
I'll motion it, because if you want to pass this, I think we should really take my feedback into consideration. So I'm going to motion to make those amendments.
State the amendments.
Sure. Firstly, I want to strike line two, because it doesn't serve any purpose. So motion to strike. So motion to strike line two. Motion to cite line 11 if there is a citation. Or strike it if that was just out of.
We'll cite it.
All right. I want to strike line 33 and 34 because. Or change it to something that says endowment per student, but that was been debunked already. And then change the title to something new that includes something about. Disclosing statistics surrounding financial aid recipients in its annual report. Or okay. Just change the title.
Okay, so there was a motion to strike line 2 and lines 11 to 13 and lines 33 to 34 and to change the name to...
Whatever Pedro and Munti decide.
Okay, so let's just do the striking first and then we'll do the name later. So there was a motion to strike those lines. Again, lines 2, lines 11 to 13.
President Blair. Lines 11 and just 11 and 12, I was just motioning to cite that. Just where is that information coming from? Not strike it.
Okay, so let's just do them one at a time. So there was a motion to strike line 2. Was that by unanimous consent? Or just... Okay, there was a second. Do we have any dissent? Okay. So, you know, dissent, line 2, for now, university's motives, any person in study has been struck from resolution 37. Okay, moving on to the second amendment that you wanted, from lines 11 to 13, either a citation or to strike it if there wasn't a citation. So, local sponsors, do you have a response to that?
We'll look into citation.
What I think would make the most sense... Okay, sorry. What I think would make the most sense to accept most of the, like, amendments, like, the one, like, the more open-ended ones, like, citing and changing names, I think what would make the, like, most logistical sense is that at the end of, like, discussion to just table it, and then we'll bring back next week with citation. But so, like, I can hear more, like, comments.
And then the final motion was to strike 33 and 34.
Okay, so it was the motion to strike 33 and 34, which speaks about the endowments of Cornell, Brown, and Dartmouth. Was that by unanimous consent? Okay, by unanimous consent. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay, do we have any dissent to that? Get your dissent.
I'd like to ask the Assembly if we could consider not striking it entirely and proposing an amendment so we can... take it back, we can look into the statistics of endowment per student and see if it's actually applicable or not and compare it with other universities and we'll come back. If President Paul's argument was indeed correct, you won't see it next week, but if it's not, we'll see better statistics.
Okay. Do you want to withdraw your motion?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So it is 6:25. I would recommend a motion to take to postpone this till next week so that we can have more discussion about it, but I can't do any motions. Representative Barwan?
Motion to postpone this resolution to next week.
Second.
There was a second by unanimous consent. Okay, do we have any dissents? No? Okay. Resolution 37, calling for Cornell University to implement need-blind admissions for all international students, has been postponed until next week. Okay. The time is 6:25, and we do have one more resolution, which is Resolution 38. Unless we think we can get through it in 5 minutes, which I suggest that we don't, I would welcome a motion to extend time. But Representative Barwal?
Motion to extend time by 10 minutes.
Motion to extend time by 10 minutes. Is there a second?
Second.
Was that by unanimous consent?
Second.
Okay. Do we have any dissent to that motion? Okay. So we are extending time by 10 minutes, so we will end at 6:40. So now we are listening to Resolution 38, supporting LGBTQ students through promoting identity-based resources on campus. So this resolution is online, so you can take out your computers and look at it there. Oh, never mind. It is
finished. Well, actually, sorry. I just wanted to make a point that the director of the LGBT Resource Center did make a little amendment to lines 42 to 46, just because she wanted to clarify that the observations made were not an official report, rather than observations made through their expertise.
And is that on the box?
It is, yes.
Okay. So take a look at the box for the most updated resolution. And with that said, let's not have any side chatter, any whispering. Let's be respectful of the people that are presenting. And you have the floor whenever you're ready.
Thank you, everyone, for being patient. I will try to make this as quick as possible. Whereas LGBTQ plus students are often hide their gender identity and sexual orientation in fear of homophobic and or transphobic violence, in 2023 alone, the ACLU reports over 450 anti-queer bills that have been introduced at the state level, creating fear for students who reside in such states. Students seeking sanctuary at Cornell as an inclusive community where they are supposed to uplift per Cornell's value of any person, any study, where identity-based violence is not condoned. Now more than ever, it is imperative that medical, physical, and online resources for queer students are made even more accessible to support the student community. It is important that queer students have the option to receive medical and mental care from faculty who are not only trained in queer medical care, but identify as queer as well, in the same way individuals prefer to receive a physical from a member of the same sex, or when individuals are looking for mental health physicians, seek those who are not only qualified but empathetic due to experience of their own. Queer students reserve the right to have healthcare professionals that can relay expertise from personal experience to the issues. Communication with the LGBT+ liaison of CAPS led to them expressing that as a queer individual themselves, they and other queer advisors would feel more than comfortable indicating that they identify as queer. There has been a communication inefficiency in connecting students to valuable on-campus resources. Resolution 18, expanding awareness of academic programs and opportunities, has previously addressed how students have lacked knowledge of valuable academic resources due to limited advertising and direct outreach to students. A similar issue occurs with identity-based resources, where communication inefficiencies create obstacles which prohibit the connection of students with necessary resources of various natures. Queer students have indicated that they knew that organizations such as the LGBT Resource Center and Haven, the LGBTQ Student Union, existed, but lacked awareness of the scope of valuable resources that they offer, creating discouragement from further seeking resources. Leaders from the LGBT Resource Center and Haven have observed that the full scope of their resources are not being fully utilized due to a lack of student awareness. These organizations wish to increase their accumulation of resources and information. However, the scope of their outreach is limited to students who can find them through social media, campus groups, and newsletter, creating inefficiencies in serving the student body's needs as they're unable to identify who is in need. Be it therefore resolved that Cornell provides a channel of central access and connections, such as creating features on platforms like Student Center, where students can opt in to receiving more detailed information regarding various queer resources on campus. Be it further resolved, providing an option to opt out temporarily or permanently if receiving this type of material poses a danger to the student's safety on the grounds of identity-based discrimination. Be it further resolved that Cornell and the deans of their respective colleges promote and provide peer resources in neutral, high-traffic areas of information to produce higher visibility of said resources with actions such as, but not limited to, highlighting peer-centered spaces along with other resources provided on campus, promoting information and opportunities regarding identity-centered spaces in their intervention email, making spaces like Loving House or other cohorts apparent as peer-centered spaces during housing selections. Be it further resolved that Cornell equips freshmen and transfer orientation leaders with a list of queer resources to make available for new students, allowing for students who are not comfortably seeking these resources to have neutral points of reception. Be it further resolved that the university allow, by preference of the provider, an indication of which health providers like HAPS identify as queer. Be it further resolved that the university strengthen the relationship with the Queer Resource Center and Haven, the LGBT Student Union, to create a centralized listing of various resources and programs on campus and an easily navigable online platform. Be it finally resolved for Cornell to express support for its queer student population to hold true to its motto, any person, any study, after a national wave of anti-LGBT plus legislation. Study submitted. I am Zachary.
And before we open this up for debate, I'd just like to highlight once again that the ACLU in 2023 alone has reported 450 and more anti-LGBTQ legislation across the nation, highlighting just how important and urgent a resolution like this is. So please bear that in mind.
Thank you for that. So we're again in debates, and we'll still do the 1 minute timer for both questions and answers. With that, we'll begin with Representative Galinsky. You have the floor. You have a minute.
So thank you both for presenting this resolution. I find the clauses from starting at 47 and ending on 52 a little bit vague. Specifically, what exact channels of central access and connection do you want to have provided? Do you want an extra tab on Student Center? Do you just want an email to be sent out? What specifically do you want?
In brainstorming with the director of the LGBT Resource Center, we were thinking about an option where it would be information regarding a box that could opt in or opt out to certain identity-based resources that they can click on and these emails can be sent to them. This could be further expanded for other identity-based resources that are available here on campus. It does not have to be exclusive to queer resources. However, I feel as though it would be beneficial for Student Center, being the center for students to go to have some sort of indication of information they would like to receive, as they usually just get, students just get dumped with information from their colleges that isn't necessarily pertaining to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Poole, you have 1 minute.
Thank you both for proposing this resolution. I'm wondering, lines 54, I have some notes here that I took earlier. I'm wondering if there might be an amendment that you guys could think of to include organizations on campus to better manage those resources. I think that it's like totally critical that these things stay up to date and they don't get left behind. And I could easily see like Cornell and the deans of the respective colleges kind of letting this slip to the side. And if it was a partnership between organizations on campus as well as Cornell, as well as the deans of the schools, being able to manage that would be a little bit more effective in keeping those resources updated. Any thoughts?
So to that point, I guess, could you clarify, like, what do you mean a little bit more specifically about, like, collaboration between organizations, like, orgs like Haven and the Resource Center, or, you know, the two of them with administration? What did you mean?
There's fault. Yeah, so I'm not super versed in the LGBTQ plus resources on campus as of now, but I would imagine that Cornell and the deans would provide resources, like funding slash other things, to organizations to manage those resources in high traffic areas. I'm just thinking about my own school, the Cal School. Like, we've got a lot of public spaces, and I could see, but there's also a lot of things going on, a lot of things being managed by the dean and other members of power, if you will, in the school. And I think that like a collaboration between an organization on campus that would be able to manage those resources in with funding or resources from the college could be really, really impactful. Does that make sense? Or no?
I think I understand the general gist. So, like, okay. Almost of a accountability infrastructure.
Yeah, perfect. Much better word than me.
Okay. We will go with Representative Williams. You have the floor. 1 minute.
Thank you guys so much. I'm fully in support of this resolution. The only suggestion I have is I'm Director of Advocacy on Residential Student Congress, and I think that utilizing the infrastructure of housing in ResLife will be really crucial in ensuring that students are connected with the resources that they need. So obviously this is a resolution, do whatever you want with it, but I was wondering if you all would be willing to add an amendment. I don't know where, but just suggesting further collaboration with RHDs, housing, RAs to ensure that everyone is connected in that space.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Williams.
Okay. We'll go with Vice President Valera. You have 1 minute.
Yeah, I just wanted to say maybe three points. The first is I actually commend the actual practicality of the further clauses 61 to 66. I think this resolution as a whole is it's a lot of advocacy based, but there's practical solutions, which I think is the example of a successful advocacy based resolution. I had a question regarding lines 21 and 22. Could you give an example of what a faculty based medical/mental care response is? Because I was a little confused, or maybe I just misread that. What kind of services or things that faculty how they kind of engage with students?
Are you talking specifically with in terms of physical and mental health, or specifically?
Yeah, I just could you explain a little bit about what you guys met with that my 21.
Yeah, so in speaking with a lot of queer students on campus, they had expressed that they felt a little uncomfortable reaching out to organizations like CAPS because a lot of their issues were rooted within their identity-based problems. And these students felt as though they couldn't seek out help because the practitioners only knew of their issues through studies and not through actual application and experience of their own, and they felt as though it would have been really beneficial if they knew which counselors themselves were queer to kind of relate and empathize with the situations that they've been through. And we, at first, there was going to be an amendment to add queer counselors. There actually are. There are a lot of queer counselors, but again, it's just a visibility issue that students don't know who they are over this world.
And just to add on to that, for clarification, we'd be amicable to amending that to replace the word faculty with medical staff, just for conciseness.
Okay, yeah.
Is that an official motion?
Yes.
Okay, there was a motion to update that wording from faculty to medical staff.
By unanimous consent.
Okay, unanimous consent. Do you have a second?
Second.
Do you have any dissent? Yes, you know, dissent, that amendment passes. The time is also 6:37, so either a motion to whatever or to extend time. With that said, we'll go with Representative Bardwatch. You have 1 minute.
Can I have a motion to extend for 5 minutes, just because I know that there are a couple of comments before we...
You can.
Okay. Motion to extend by 5 minutes by unanimous consent.
Second.
It was a second. We have any dissent? Okay, we have extended the time to 6:45. We're back in open debate. We'll go with Representative Mitchell Coy. You have 1 minute.
Hello. I was pretty surprised to see 5 abstentions in the D&I committee. I looked at this. Do you know if they were not present for the vote? Okay, so yeah.
Yeah, I can happily explain that. So we wanted to make sure this hit the agenda as soon as possible, so we did an email vote, not over meeting. I did send follow-up texts and emails asking members to vote. Unfortunately, not everyone was reachable, but I would imagine that everyone would have been in support of the resolution.
Okay. Yeah, just had to ask. Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other comments? Okay. Representative Barwatch, you have 1 minute.
One, thank you for this resolution. As a queer student myself, I very much see and understand and have experienced all the things that are listed here. I would like to provide a friendly amendment on line 23 when it says, in the same way individuals prefer to receive a physical from a member of the same sex, to change sex to gender. So motion to amend line 23 to strike sex and replace it.
What's the motion? Do you have a second?
Second.
Do you have any dissent? I mean, was it by unanimous consent?
Yes.
Okay. Unanimous consent. Do we have any dissent? Okay. So, you know, the sense, we have changed 923 to read instead of sex, it reads gender. We're also at 16 students, so if we lose one more representative, we will have to end this meeting.
Thank you guys for the patience. I'm just going to go ahead and, for transparency, make one more amendment to address some of the comments that we've had and then motion to move into voting if that's possible. So I motion to amend by unanimous consent to add on to on the line after line 68 to say, be it further resolved for Cornell administration to further collaborate with Housing and Residential Life to further promote identity-based resources for the LGBTQ community.
Unanimous consent. Do we have a second?
Second.
Do we have any dissent? Okay. Seeing no dissent, that amendment has been added on line 68. We are back in open session. So with Representative Katie. Motion to end the debate. Unanimous consent. We had a second. Do we have any dissent? Okay, we have ended the debate. We are now in voting. Was that a motion to vote unanimously as well, or regular voting?
I'd like to motion to pass with unanimous consent.
So the motion was for unanimous consent. Okay, there was a motion to pass.
Second.
There was a second. Do we have any dissent? Seeing no dissent, Resolution 38, supporting LGBTQ students, has been passed unanimously. There is nothing on the agenda. I do need a motion to adjourn. There was a motion to adjourn.
Second.